Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we are very fortunate to have as our guest someone who truly qualifies as a living legend, one of the great giants of American book publishing, Andre Schifrin, longtime publisher of Pantheon Books, more recently the founder and publisher of New Press, will be joining us today live on the air to talk about his career in book publishing, the state of book publishing today, and his brand new book, A Political Education. So please join us today for Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Federal Communications Commission is under fire from all sides these days. On March 14th, all five commissioners appeared before the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Telecommunications and the Internet. Most of the tough questioning was reserved for FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, who suffered numerous contentious exchanges with representatives on a wide variety of issues, ranging from the lack of a national broadband development policy to new allegations of spiked agency studies, the latest involving a report which would have detailed the FCC's failure to develop and deploy effective 911 service for mobile phones. Martin got quite an earful from Michigan Representative John Dingell, who blasted the FCC for not doing enough to crack down on the production and distribution of fake news and radio payola.
You know, I was on this committee years ago when we went into the question of payola. Have you studied the history of that?
We've tried, but I'm sure not enough.
It was an interesting thing. It resulted in departure from public service by a large number of people, including folks at the commission. And if my memory serves me correctly, it also resulted in some good-hearted folks going to jail. Seems like not just the musical industry, but very frankly, the government engages in a little payola.
A week earlier, three of the five commissioners attended a free press-sponsored town meeting on the future of media held in Columbus, Ohio. It was the first unofficial public forum on the subject to be attended by a Republican commissioner. Robert McDowell faced hundreds of citizens concerned about concentrated media and pledged to keep an open mind as the agency considers modifying its media ownership regulations.
This is my first foray into the media ownership debate, my first steps, if you will, into the eye of the storm. And I've learned quickly that the debate elicits the strong opinions and passions of people from all walks of life, from all over America. And your firsthand knowledge about how our ownership rules affect you as viewers, listeners, business people, consumers, students, etc., will help us determine whether or not the times demand that those rules change or not.
The FCC's announced its fourth official public hearing on media ownership, and it will take place on April 30th in Tampa, Florida. Visit www.stopbigmedia.com for further details. Just how important is the principle of network neutrality to the preservation of an open online environment? According to Sir Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web, net neutrality is a no-brainer. Speaking before the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Telecommunications and the Internet, Berners-Lee told its members that the entire political dispute over the rights of everyone to connect to the content of their choice without paying extra for delivery above and beyond the fees we all pay to get online is primarily an American phenomenon.
My impression is that in other countries that net neutrality is very much the assumption as opposed to something which is questioned.
Unlike phone and cable companies, which say they need to discriminate between online content providers in order to make more money, Sir Tim asserts that this business model would stifle the innovative nature of web development.
If I had charged from the word go for, you know, per click, the World Wide Web would not have taken off at all. We would not be here talking about it.
In fact, were the United States to decide not to preserve network neutrality as a fundamental point of telecommunications law, Berners-Lee believes that may unleash an exodus of brains and money from its tech sector.
If we had a situation in which the U.S. had serious flaws in its net neutrality, but, for example, Europe, did have net neutrality, I must say, and I was going to start a company, then I would be very tempted to move.
Citizen activists involved in the SaveTheInternet.com coalition have been working hard to convince members of Congress of the importance of passing a network neutrality law. Within the last month, they've held meetings with some 24 congressional offices involving members from across the country. One bill, the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, is pending in the Senate and has at least 10 supporters on board. Similar legislation will be introduced in the House of Representatives sometime this spring.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, this lovely Sunday afternoon from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a terrific show for you today. We're going to be talking with one of the most prominent book publishers in the United States in the past several decades, really going back to the 1960s, the publisher of Pantheon Books, now the founder and creator of New Press out of New York City. Our guest today is also the author of a brand new book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York, literally just published this month. It's my pleasure to welcome to Media Matters Andre Schifrin. Well, it's a real pleasure to have you here. And I had a chance, as you know, Andre Schifrin, to read your book this week. And it was literally a book I couldn't put down. I hadn't planned to read the whole book during the week before we get you on the show. I planned to read it later, but I started it and I couldn't stop it. The book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York. And this is your second book in the last few years. You wrote one, The Business of Books, which has been translated into 23 languages about 4 or 5 years ago. And now you've come out with A Political Education. What was the thinking behind writing this book?
Well, the first book, as you say, Bob, had been about how publishing had altered, how my own life within it had changed with the changes in the industry as a whole. But I had tried very hard not to make it a personal book in any way. And in this book, I realized that I had left out an awful lot, and also that I hadn't thought through a great deal in my life as to why I had done what I'd done and how the overall picture had changed in American politics since I'd come to this country in 1941. So that was the major impetus to write this book and try and uncover really not only things past, but ideas past and why they had disappeared.
Now, you came from France at the age of 5, if I'm not mistaken, or 6.
By the time I got here.
It's a long journey. Your father was a very successful book publisher with one of the largest houses in Paris. Forced to leave when the Nazis invaded and conquered France. And the Jews at the publishing house were purged, the two of them, it was Aryanized. And a long, harrowing journey via, if I'm not mistaken, Spain, then, it was Casablanca.
Right.
Until you finally did make it to New York City. And a lot of the book is not only about that journey, but also growing up in New York City in the 1940s, in the early 1950s, becoming an American. And I found that really a fascinating discussion in a lot of ways, not the least of which is, for me, how much the country has really changed from the period you described in the 1940s.
Right. Well, that's the thing that fascinated me the most as I wrote the book, is to look back and see how completely different the political scene was from the one I'd grown up in. Because when I was a kid in high school, junior high school, we would discuss politics in a way that no one does anymore. Even before Truman's Fair Deal, the debate that was going on was really a post-war debate on how America should be rebuilt after the war. And one of the things that I've discovered since writing the book was that in 1942, a quarter of the population thought that America should have some kind of a socialist government after the war, and only 40% were against it. And the ideas that were prevalent were really a continuation of the New Deal ideas. So in my high school civics newspaper, published by the people who do Scholastic now, we would have every week a discussion of what should the levels of unemployment be? Should it be 2% or 3%? Should we have nationalized health insurance? Should we even nationalize the railroads and the mines, as everyone in Western Europe had done? So the debate then, in the pre-McCarthy time, was a debate that could have taken place, really, in most of Western Europe. And then after that, of course, the situation changed drastically.
How, Andre Schifrin, how drastically did it change with the coming of the Cold War, with what's called McCarthyism? Was it a palpable shift? In your view, was McCarthyism overrated as a phenomenon in subsequent years? What exactly took place in this country's political culture?
Well, that's a very interesting and complex question, because certainly after the beginning of the Cold War, things did change enormously. In 1946, for instance, most people in the Democratic Party wanted Wallace to be the candidate rather than Truman, and Wallace represented a very left-wing view of the Democratic ideal and a desire to work with Russia in a way that seemed impossible after the Cold War began. So there was a shift of that sort, which was very considerable. McCarthyism in itself was a curious phenomenon, because for the most part, McCarthy was theoretically attacking the communists in government, but there were no communists in government to speak of. So it was really a question of building up a climate of fear in the country as a whole, and a prophylactic kind of climate where people would be afraid to speak up in any way. As a kid, when I was 13, or during the 1948 election, I would still go to a communist bookstore or a Wallace or socialist or other headquarter to see what people were saying, and I wasn't afraid to do that, and no one thought it at all unusual. A year or two later, if I did that, the people in the communist bookstore, the one remaining in New York, would point to the hidden FBI camera in the ceiling and warn me that I was being photographed. Simply by walking into the store. And when I got to Yale in 53, I've since discovered, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a full-time FBI office there keeping an eye on, you know, the most conservative and careful of possible campuses. So that was a very curious and continuing pressure, which lasted after the McCarthy hearings, when presumably McCarthy army hearings, when McCarthy was presumably no longer a factor in the country's politics.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Andre Schifrin, a longtime book publisher, publisher of Pantheon from the 1960s through the 1980s, founder and first publisher of The New Press in New York City. Andre Schifrin is the author of the brand new book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York. If I'm not mistaken, Andre, this is literally just coming off the presses this month. Is that right?
Right. It's just landed in the bookstores this week, so you're practically the first to be talking about it, which I'm delighted with.
Well, I'm delighted, too, and I should say as a matter of disclosure that New Press has published two of my books, and I hope many more books in the future, but I think that has no bearing on why Andre Schifrin is a guest of ours today on this program. I think our listeners are going to be especially interested, Andre, in your career in book publishing and also your political education, because this is a show about media and about politics. And after you finished college and you did some graduate work in Cambridge and spent some time in England, you returned to the United States and fairly soon became involved with Pantheon and moved up the ladder, so to speak, quite quickly. And I recall when I first met you in your apartment in New York City, we were sitting talking in your living room, and behind you, you got up to take a phone call or something, and I looked at the bookshelf that was right behind you, and there was about 100 books in it, and about 50 of them were classics by authors, Turkle, Chomsky, the list goes on, of just some of the most extraordinary writers of the 1960s and 70s. And I was just in awe of the bookshelf. I said, boy, this guy's really got some good books. And then you came back and sat down, and I said, well, that's a pretty interesting bookshelf. You said, oh, those are the books I edited. And it was quite an education that I got at that moment as to the scope of your career in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, one of the things that comes across to me as I read A Political Education was the important role book publishing played in rejuvenating the American political culture of the 1960s and 1970s.
Right. Well, you know, the question of the media in all of this is absolutely crucial. And in the chapters I write on the McCarthy period, I talk about how difficult it was to find anything in New York City that was dissenting from the prevailing climate of fear. There was one newsstand left near the public library where you could buy a left-wing newspaper, or usually from abroad, because there were very few left in the U.S. So the fact that material is there, that you can read what other people have to say, what you can read that comes from abroad, is absolutely crucial, I think, in keeping people's minds open during any political situation, and certainly during a situation as fearful as that of the 50s. What happened when I started at Pantheon is that I discovered that a huge number of people who I had admired and who I came to admire had not been published in recent years. When I.F. Stone wanted to publish his book, for instance, in the 50s, he wasn't able to find a single publisher in the U.S. Or in England to take him on until the newly founded Monthly Review Press decided to do his first book on the Truman era. And when I suggested that we do I.F. Stone at Pantheon at the beginning of the 60s, there was still a great deal of reticence to take him on because he seemed a politically dangerous observer, though he was practically the only one to write critically about our involvement in the Korean War and so on and so forth. So really, when I started to publish, it was at a time when a huge number of really important authors from Europe and from England and from the United States had not been available, simply not been published. And then, of course, at that time, a new generation of people came so that we were able to publish both from Europe and from the U.S. A new scholarship that was flourishing in history and social sciences and women's studies and so on. And so in that respect, I came in just at the right time, but it was a time when we talk of Russia, we talk about the thaw after the years of Stalinist fear, but there was a period of thaw in the U.S. as well.
Our guest today, Andre Schifrin, author of the brand new book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York, just published. Andre Schifrin is the longtime publisher of Pantheon Books and the founder and publisher of New Press in New York City. If anyone would like to call in with a question or comment here on WILL AM 580 for Andre Schifrin, the telephone number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And the subject of this book, A Political Education, is exactly what the title is. It's about your own coming to terms with politics. I mean, you are quite clearly, it's evident in this book, from a very early age, fascinated by and engrossed by politics, and has continued throughout your life. In the 1960s was certainly, and early 1970s was a dramatic period politically in this country. Could you make money publishing books by people like Studs Terkel and Noam Chomsky and even more obscure authors in the 1960s? How were you able to do this?
Well, at the beginning, of course, you took authors on not knowing whether you would make money, which is the traditional role of a good publishing house. And I had the good luck of moving into Pantheon, which my father had helped to run for many years, but he had died in 1950, and I had never thought I would see a place in that firm again. But when I came in, the firm had just been bought up by Random House, who'd also just bought up Alfred Knopf. And in those days, very much unlike the situation today, the people who ran the firm were real publishers who knew that you had to take risks, who didn't expect to make money in the short term. And even the big commercial firms, I might add, like Doubleday, said, oh, they didn't expect to make money out of their hardcover books at all. They thought they would make money in the long run on book clubs and paperbacks and the like. So it was not unusual to publish books by authors who were not sure moneymakers. And, of course, one of the great things and one of the great pleasures in publishing is when you do take on someone like Studs, then his books become bestsellers right away and continue to do so until this very day. And I just finished last week editing Studs' own memoirs, which he's finishing at the age of 95. And so that's been over 40 years of working together. But I should add that Studs was an example of someone who had been silenced by the McCarthy period. He had been one of the most promising Americans in television, but was known as the Chicago School of Television in those days with people like Dave Garraway, whose name may now be forgotten. And Studs was a leading, most promising star of the early TV screen. When the McCarthy period came, he was fired from every job he had. And when I suggested to him that he try writing books, I came in really very much out of the blue as far as he was concerned. He had been relegated to being what he called a disc jockey at the time.
Our guest, Andre Schifrin, talking about his career in book publishing in the United States at Pantheon, later at New Press. And we're also talking about his brand new book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York. Phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. For anyone who'd like to call, we do have one caller who has been patiently waiting. Let's go to line one, Champaign County, right now. You're on the air with Andre Schifrin. Hello, caller. Okay, apparently we cannot...
Hello, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, our caller's...
Yeah, I wasn't waiting that patiently. I just got on, and I'm
having
phone difficulties.
We knew it was you, so we decided to go right to the call.
Got to the chase here. Is there a backstory on the publishing of Deterring Democracy by Chomsky? I understand that was maybe one of the last Pantheon imprints of him, and whether that was right before the sale, and... there's anything on that. On a completely different subject, I'm trying to learn French by watching internet French TV, and I've seen a long discussion about Hannah Arendt and Martin Heidegger, and I wonder if there's anything real reason that you can think of why that's back in the discourse right now, and if that's just too off the wall, maybe something on the French election. I realize this is pretty far from your books, but as an observer of France, I think maybe it might be a worthy question, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And in fact, this has not come up yet. It was a prescient call because Andre Schifrin now lives 6 months a year in France and is immersed, I think, in French politics like few Americans are. I think there's anyone equipped to talk about the upcoming French presidential election, it would be Andre. And also, Andre, your book, you discuss Hannah Arendt on several points. Actually, you took a class with her when you were a young man. So please go ahead and deal with the questions.
Right. Well, there are three different questions, and there was no hidden stories to Chomsky that I can think of. We published a great many of his books with enormous success. And in those days, of course, his books were widely reviewed. The last book of Chomsky's that we did, called Understanding Power, which has now sold close to 100,000 copies, did so without a single word, literally not a single word, in any paper or any magazine in America. So that's one of the great changes that has taken place since the 60s, since you raised the question. As to Hannah Arendt, it's the centenary of her birth this year, and so there are endless biographies and articles about her, and new biographies are appearing everywhere. I had the good fortune to study with her when I was in high school. There was a small socialist adult education school next to my school called the Rand School, where she taught a class, which was attended by my mother, myself, and four garment workers. And I think she was just finished the Origins of Totalitarianism, and so that class was the most exciting I've had in my whole life, I think. But it's interesting to notice that she did not get an academic job for 15 years after she'd come to the U.S., and she could at best get little jobs like the one at the Rand School. And now that there's this kind of hagiography around Arendt, it's important to realize that we were nowhere near as hospitable to refugee intellectuals as we now like to think. And the fact that it was very hard for people like Hannah to get a job is an important statement about the lack of openness in America for a very long period, not just because of McCarthy, but simply because of an unwillingness to listen to new ideas. The last question about the French election is that clearly it's going to be a very difficult and odd race with now three leading candidates and then practically a dozen other candidates from the smaller parties, including Le Pen, who may be able to get 10 or 12% of the vote as the far right-wing racist, basically fascist candidate. The problem with Le Pen's presence is that it's led the conservative candidate, Sarkozy, to move in his direction in the hope of getting the votes that he would have garnered otherwise. And consequently, the socialist candidate, Rael, has moved to a kind of Hillary Clinton position in the hope of persuading people that she's as conservative as they want and that they don't have to vote for Sarkozy. So Le Pen has indeed pushed things very much to the right in a very frightening way, though, of course, anyone who watches American politics and sees to what degree the far right wing has been able to move the center to the to the far right is a very analogous situation. We'll have to wait and see in a few weeks how the vote goes. But the depressing aspect of the debate so far is that the center has shifted, and we have the Socialist Party, which used to be well to the left of the British Labour Party, now trying to sound like Blair.
André Chiffrin, you spent a year in France in 2003-04, and now spend 6 months a year living in Paris. And you had not lived in France before that, and going back into the time you were 5 years old. What do you think surprised you the most about living in France from what you would have expected? And what do you think about France would surprise most of our listeners that they wouldn't learn from U.S. education or U.S. news media?
Well, just about everything. If you look at the U.S. news media, it barely covers France and usually does so in a very stilted and biased fashion. I mean, for years, the Times felt that its correspondents there were there to lecture the French on the evils of the welfare state rather than on telling the American public what was going on. So there were two things that surprised me in France. One, first of all, was how very pleasant and comfortable life there is. Not simply because there's a 35-hour week or people have 6 or 7 weeks vacations per year, but because there is still a feeling that the government is there to make life possible or even comfortable for most people. And you feel it. You feel it when you look at the streets, which are incredibly clean, or you ride the subway, which is very efficient, or you simply look at the way people spend their day in a way that Americans, I think, would love to have if they thought it was at all possible. The flip side of that and the unhappy side of that is that the French have been as bad on resolving their racial problems as we have, or perhaps even worse, in that you have a 10% of the population that came from Africa, North Africa for the most part, that's been relegated to outer-lying housing developments, which by American standards look very good. There's no Cabrini Green there at all, but they are segregated and they do feel they have no chance to integrate themselves into French society, and that has led to the riots and so on that we read about.
Go ahead, André, excuse me.
No, I'm just going to say that is a major crisis. And, the unemployment among the French immigrants in the second generation is close to 50%. On the other hand, and most Americans aren't aware of this, the unemployment in New York City, the permanent unemployment for black and Latino men, is 39.6%. So we see lots of articles about the French problems and much less about an analogous situation in the U.S.
Our guest, André Chiffrin, you're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so please feel free to call in if you wish. Our telephone number, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. André Chiffrin is, I think it's fair to say, a legendary book publisher in the United States, author of two books, recent books, The Business of Books, now translated into 23 languages, which came out, maybe 5 years ago, I'm guessing.
Right.
And this brand new book, literally off the presses this month, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York, which I had the privilege of reading this week. Call in if you have questions and comments. We do have a caller now waiting patiently on line one. Let's go to the call now. Champagne, you're on the air with André Chiffrin.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Several things. I'm also learning French, but primarily to read. I have several questions and or comments. Could you talk about the French healthcare system? My impression is it's fairly good and it covers all. It's more or less a single payer, single government system as opposed to the British system, which is apparently a two-tier system and has all sorts of problems. Two, every time the media has something, I can't think of what exactly it was, the workers, or if you quit, you could be fired. Whatever, there was a tremendous upheaval a year or so ago about jobs, people. I can't really quite remember exactly what it was, but it caused a number of demonstrations and so forth. But the way it was portrayed in the media, it was almost as if the reporters were devotees of Milton Friedman, the way they talked about how much the French people wanted the government to take care of them and so forth. So I get the impression the American media, as you just touched on, do not do a good job of portraying what France is really like, and I'm especially interested in their healthcare system. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. André?
Well, thank you. Well, I should mention that for a couple of years in France now, I've been teaching a course at Sciences Po, which is their leading graduate school in political science, on how to read a newspaper. And we read the French and the British and American papers. And when the students read the American press, they're just in shock. They cannot believe how inaccurate it is, how mendacious it is, how totally unable to cover what's happening in the rest of the world the papers are. And certainly the coverage of the French and the European welfare system is part of that story. I have yet to see a good article on healthcare in Europe at all, in Scandinavia or France or anything of that sort, as opposed to the way it is here. I make use of the French system happily and with a great deal of pleasure. We get prescriptions for practically nothing. The government pays for most of it. If you visit a doctor, the fee is $20, or 20 euros rather, maximum. And the major costs are, as you say, a single-payer system, which works very efficiently. And the level of care is very high. So, and the French, of course, like the other socialized health systems, spend a fraction of what we do on medical care overall. I think the average is a third of what the U.S. spends, with far better results. So I think the question is also about the media, and I think that's an important issue as to why do the American papers and TV stations and others do such a terrible job in covering how the rest of the world lives and what the alternatives are, obviously, to the way we live. As far as the closing of plants are concerned, that's another aspect of French life, which I think is, again, a major issue in terms of contrast to the U.S. The French, on the whole, don't believe that the free market is the answer. In fact, in a recent poll, when people were asked, do you think it's the future that you want, two-thirds said no. And they feel that if a company is making money, there's no reason for it to close down a plant in France just because they can get the same manufacturing process for a lot less in another country. And they, I think quite rightly, say there's no reason for companies to close down just to move to Slovakia or someplace else. At this point, to use that example, more cars are produced in Slovakia per capita than any country in Europe because they pay their wages a quarter of what is earned in Western Europe, even though it might be added that the French productivity is the highest, is much higher than the U.S. productivity per worker. So you have a situation where the French have not accepted the logic of globalization in the way that we do, where we say, oh, well, fine, you know, let every country do what it does best. And so that means that we run up a debt and everybody else produces what we want to use. And, of course, you know, again, the best laid plans in this respect don't always work. All of our plans were supposed to go to Mexico, and then it turned out the Mexicans were going to be undercut by people in Asia. And so the poor Mexicans are left holding the bag, as we saw when Bush visited the other day. So you have a whole question of world, global economics, how we fit into it, and how badly it's covered in the media.
Andre Schifrin, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Andre, to follow up on this point, since you do spend time in France, I guess I'm turning you into our de facto Benjamin Franklin reporting back to the provinces on what's happening in the old world. I hear periodically, and I think many of our listeners do, that the United States is at a low ebb in terms of respect and popularity around the world, and I think the country that's at the top of the list outside of the Islamic countries would be France. From your experience there, how is the United States regarded, not just in France, but to the extent you feel comfortable generalizing across Europe, and how does this compare to earlier times? Because I know you've traveled annually to Europe in business for the last 40 years.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that surprised me when I got to Paris was how pro-American, on the whole, the people were. There's an enormous liking for America. Everyone wants to come here. They want to go and work in New York. The newspapers spend more time reviewing American fiction than even the American press does, not to compare how little time we spent covering European fiction. When the least known of American folk singers or jazz musicians dies, there's a long obituary in Le Monde for people who are barely noticed in the American papers at all. So there's a huge interest in American culture and American history and Americans as a whole, which leads, of course, to the enormous disappointment in what Bush has done and the feeling that the Americans really try to recreate the sort of colonialist failure that Europe had acknowledged a long time ago. So the French were in the lead in opposing the war, the invasion of Iraq, and are now, and by the way, that was the conservative government that was opposed to it, and they're now, I think, in agreement that they were all right to try to stop it, and very regretful that they weren't able to do so. So I think what you get in England and in Spain and in other countries of Europe is something of a similar mix. That is, American popular culture has enormous sway. American high culture is perhaps even overestimated. The political culture of the Bush years is something that simply appalled people. The British, after all, had colonized Iraq right after the First World War, and the general who came in there made a great speech about how they were there to liberate Iraq and bring democracy. And of course, the French have lived through the Vietnam and Algerian wars and know what a disaster maintaining that kind of colonial war was. So no one was fooled for a minute by the Bush argument is that we were just there out of sheer idealism and we were going to help bring democracy to the Iraqi people after we'd, of course, failed to bring democracy to any of our client states in the area. So people are very sophisticated in that respect, and they're very shocked and very saddened by what America's done, because it's really made life for them much more difficult, but also it's broken the illusion of having an America that they so like.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Andre Schifrin, who you've just been listening to, he's the author of the brand new book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York, just published this month by Melville House Publishing, based out of Hoboken, New Jersey. Andre Schifrin, the longtime publisher of Pantheon Books, and then the founder and first publisher of New Press, The New Press, based in New York, still an active publisher, and I'm proud to say a publisher of a couple of my books. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Andre Schifrin, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Andre Schifrin, before we go back to the phones to a couple of patient callers who are waiting, I do want to ask you, if I can, about one of the theses of the business of books, and then something that you return to in the final two or three chapters of Political Education, which is what happened to book publishing, the process that took place gradually, but gathering a great deal of steam by the 1980s, that pretty much forced you, as arguably the leading book publisher in the United States, out of the commercial industry by 1990?
Well, the process is one, of course, that you've described yourself in broadcasting very well in your marvelous books. But what's happened is that publishing was in America, as it was throughout Europe, mostly family-owned, smallish public firms that were happy to make a profit of 3 or 4% a year. That was the average profit in Europe and in the U.S. for well over a century. People published books that they believed in. They published books they hoped would make money, and the idea was that those would pay for the books that were important and weren't as profitable. And that was pretty much the kind of publishing I came into, and one that lasted through the 60s. What happened afterwards was the beginning of the purchasing of firms by conglomerates. And the conglomerates own television and newspapers and so on. And maybe we can talk about newspapers a little later. The newspapers were making, as an average, nationally 26% a year, of course, because of the advertising.
They were a very lucrative industry compared to book publishing.
Indeed. And the feeling of the conglomerates was, well, why should publishing not be as profitable? Why should we, as it were, subsidize publishing when the rest of our holdings are infinitely more profitable? And so the idea came about that publishing should make not 3 or 4%, but 15 or 20% a year. And the five great groups that now control American publishing, that is 80% of all books, trade books that come out, come from these five groups, the Bertelsmann and the Murdoch groups and others, all change enormously the nature of of the book publishing industry. And what happened with us at Pantheon is that after years of publishing books that we believed in and that were doing perfectly well, we were told, no, each book now has to make a profit by itself and a profit pretty soon after it's published, which meant, in effect, that you couldn't publish any serious books anymore because those take time and they don't always make money. But they are the core of what you're supposed to be doing. So the result of all of that has been that most of American publishing has now been forced into this iron mask, as it were, of high-profit capitalism, and also into a situation where they depend on the profits of the group as a whole. And going back to Iraq for a minute, one of the things that shocked me the most is that during the first 2 years of the Bush administration, the crucial years when the war was being decided upon, not only did the newspapers and television stations refuse to talk about the lies that were coming out of Washington, but the book publishers did as well. No major house for the first 2 years published a single book critical of Bush's Iraq policy. Now, these were not commercial decisions because half of the country, more than half, had voted for Gore, and therefore there was no lack of customers, as we've seen since. These were decisions that were based both on an unwillingness to unsettle the White House and also because the White House, as you pointed out so effectively, was about to use the FCC to grant major profits to the newspaper and television holdings of the same conglomerates. So we have a situation where not only was the level of publishing affected, but the level of democratic discourse was threatened.
Our guest, Andre Schifrin. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting very patiently to speak with Andre Schifrin. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's go to our toll-free number, Line 4, Indiana. You're on the air with Andre Schifrin.
Hello. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'd like to change the subject a little and ask Mr. Schifrin about what he sees as the future of specifically academic, university, press, scholarly publishing, if the big publishing houses have gone to this profit-based motivation. Is it possible that the kind of small presses that scholars and university students depend on are going to go under in the same way? Thanks. I'll listen to the answer off the air.
Great. Well, thanks. It's an important question, and one which I addressed in The Business of Books, where there's a long chapter on what's happened to university publishing. But, of course, it's a microcosm of what's happened in the society as a whole. And that is that in most universities, there is now a profit pressure on the press as well. Most of them want to profit from the press, and they don't want to subsidize the press anymore. And what's happened as a result is that more and more university presses are trying to become commercial publishers. And that's a great great disappointment, both for the world of scholarship and for the readers as a whole, which is not to say that the presses have not tried hard. But when you have a situation where, you know, the University Press of Kentucky specializes in books on baseball and other presses specialize on guidebooks and cookbooks and so on, you could sympathize with the difficulties that they're undergoing when their own ownership says you have to make money, and you have to make money every year. And, of course, we've seen that in the universities as a whole, where departments are considered to be profit centers rather than centers of academic work. At the University of Chicago, every department has to make a profit, and the accountants come around every 3 months, just as they do in a large corporation, saying, you know, have you lived up to the budget, just in the same way as they do with the press itself. So what we're talking about, and it is a broader problem which affects not just universities but the society as a whole, is how there are very, very few now enclaves left that are not simply geared to the stresses of making money. And that's why we started the new press as a not-for-profit. It was a university press, as it were, without a university. That is, we wanted to show that you could continue to publish important and good books without the expectation of money, either for the company or for the people working in it. And I think we've shown, as have a lot of other independent publishers that have been started since, that you can get companies that are interesting and intelligent and entrepreneurial without being guided entirely or at all by the profit motive.
Andre Schifrin, how has the internet changed book publishing, the business of book publishing in the United States? And has it been for the better, for the worse, or a little bit of each?
Well, there was originally the feeling that, you know, everybody would be able to publish their books on the internet and download them and so on, and that just hasn't worked, partly for technical reasons, because, you know, by the time you've paid for the paper on a hardcover book, you've paid for the cost of printing it out. And also because, of course, the problem is not simply printing the book, it's getting it written. And the internet is simply not up to that. And, you know, important as the internet is in talking about books and telling people that the books are there, in discussing them, and we could imagine that if Chomsky has sold close to 100,000 copies, it's because of the notices the book has gotten on the internet. The creation of the work itself is simply not something that the internet is now structured to afford. The one place, and this answers the university press question as well, where it has worked very well, and this is due to a massive grant from the Mellon Foundation, is that scholarly monographs are increasingly being made available on the internet so they can be downloaded by university libraries or by scholars, where you know there's a very small targeted audience that can be made aware of the existence of the book. But otherwise, you know, the university presses had reached the point where they were selling 350 copies worldwide of a monograph, and obviously that's non-economical, and that's been a good solution. But for new writing and to get people to write new books, the internet simply is not up to it yet.
One person emailed, a listener emailed in, Andre Schifrin, asking what advice you would give someone who wanted to set up a new book publishing company today, and how would that advice differ from the same advice you would have given to that person 25 years ago?
Well, my publishers at Belleville House joke that when they asked me through a friend should they start a new publishing house, my answer to them was don't try it, it's too difficult. And they have succeeded, and it can be done with a relatively small amount of money. But the best way to start is to be linked to some institution that can give you some sort of support. Dahlke Archive, for instance, at Normal, Illinois, at the University of Illinois campus there, has become one of the major reprinters of European fiction because they have a base at a university. They have an office there, and one of their professors is allowed to use part of his time to be the chief editor. So if you have any kind of institutional base, and it doesn't have to be a university, you're going to have a much easier time of it than otherwise. We tend to forget that there used to be a major amount of publishing, and indeed of newspaper publishing in Europe, that was linked to churches, that was linked to political parties, that was linked to the cooperative movement, to trade unions, and so on. A lot of these groups had publishing houses as part of their mandate. That's more or less disappeared, and there's no reason why that should be the case. There's no reason why we couldn't get back into a situation where publishers have this sort of support. And Beacon Press, for instance, one of the best of the independent publishers out of Boston, has been supported for years by the Unitarian Church, and the Catholic Church has also had a number of impressive publishers.
Andre Schifrin, our guest today on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines if we can. Line 1, Urbana, Illinois, you're on the air with Andre Schifrin.
Andre Schifrin, it's a pleasure indeed to talk to you. Ben Franklin, indeed, Robert. You're probably right here. Now, Andre, the question of fascism is back on the table with the publication of Chris Hedges' American Fascists. Can we return to the Joe McCarthy question briefly? McCarthy began his career as a state organizer of the Young People's Socialist League. He had a state office. And, of course, it was in Wisconsin, where I grew up. It was the Socialist Party had a mayor in Milwaukee while he was running the House on American Activities Committee, but there was a struggle. And here the Trotskyists, the CP, and, of course, the entire left were opposed to him and worked very assiduously at undermining his base in Appleton, Wisconsin. Now, on the question of fascism, old man Trotsky always said, if you permit me, one of our historical sages, that fascism originates on the left. So here we have the spectacle of a socialist mayor in Milwaukee, Zeidler, and we have this neo-fascist McCarthy in the Senate running the House on American Activities, or in the House running the House on American Activities Committee. And what is your definition, Andre, of modern fascism, if you would permit the question? And I thank you very much for taking my call. I'll ring off.
All right, thank you very much. And Andre, if I could also ask you, while you're working on your treatise on fascism, if you could maybe talk a little bit about, since you mentioned the term fascism, talking about French politics and Le Pen, if you could specifically talk about the current situation in the United States politically and how you think it's changing from 5, 10, 15 years ago and evolving, and your sense of either promise or despair or both.
Well, on the McCarthy question, I must say I've never heard of McCarthy being involved with the socialists in any way, and that's something new to me, and I haven't seen that in any of the biographies. Zeidler, you know, was for 26 years mayor of Milwaukee as part of the Norman Thomas Socialist Party, and did a very good job as far as I can remember. I think McCarthy's advantage was that he was able to work very early on with J. Edgar Hoover and others in trying to slander and libel not only people he thought were communists, but people who were old New Dealers. And that did include, by the way, a number of old socialists who had gone to work for the government in various very important jobs. But I think the idea that McCarthy was a form of American fascism is probably a little too complicated to make sense. And at the time, certainly people thought that might be the case. In fact, Hannah Arendt, to go back to her, actually wrote saying that she thought not only that McCarthy might be a Hitler, but that Eisenhower was going to be his Hindenburg, that is, the old doddering wartime hero who was going to let the young man take over. And, of course, for a short while, it did look as if Eisenhower was going to let McCarthy have his way until McCarthy went too far. But fascism is an odd mixture, and I think Hedges is right to write about the mixture, which is one which is a very reactionary right-wing economic theory, which tries to get the working class masses to go along with it, and underneath it, at least in Nazi Germany and in France, a strong racist component, and which used the racism of many people to try and move them to the right and forget their economic interests. And, of course, that's what we saw to some degree with Nixon's Southern strategy and with Reagan's appeal to the blue-collar Democrats. It was a very astute and clever use of racism to take working-class people away from their economic interests and to have them vote along lines of racist populism, which is not quite the same as fascism, but nonetheless it proved to be very effective. And Tom Frank, of course, has been a very good analyst in his What Happened in Kansas and looking at the way in which the Republicans succeeded in taking away from the Democrats a large number of their would-be voters. And it is true that people can move from one to the other. A lot of the places in France that vote now for Le Pen were people who had originally voted for the French Communist Party. But that comes also from the feeling of despair that things aren't going to work out, that you're being left behind, and so on. And the right-wing extremists are able to play on that as effectively as anyone else. I think the use of the word fascism to cover this mix of racist and populist reactionary appeals may be misleading, because immediately you have to say, well, is it like Mussolini? Is it like Franco? Is it even like the Germans who were Nazis rather than fascists? And then you get into all sorts of complicated historical debates. But certainly, and we've seen this in Europe throughout, in fact, even in Scandinavia, you have now strong right-wing anti-immigrant parties that sound very much like the Republicans do in Arizona. And this is an issue that obtains throughout the West. And one of the factors that everyone tends to forget is that all of the Western industrialized countries have a negative population growth. We all need to import workers from abroad, and our governments on the whole are not willing to admit that. And so it's easy for people to say, wait a minute, these guys are taking our jobs. without realizing that there are long-term underlying demographic reasons why everyone has turned to the same policy of bringing in people from the South to work in the North.
Well, Andre Schifrin, what is your take on American politics today, the present and future, immediate and maybe even longer term? I mean, you, in your book, you really, I think, you know, talk about moments of great politicization and hope in this country, the 1940s, the 1960s, and early 1970s, and then longer periods where there's been less hope and more despair. And I think you described the 80s going into the 90s as clearly one of the periods of despair. Are we still in the despair zone? Where are we in your calculation?
Well, I think, you know, we have begun, now that you have a vast majority in the country against the Iraqi war, where you have 60% of the population in yesterday's public opinion polls disapproving of what Bush has been doing with the Attorney General on the state level. You have a growing disillusion with what was going on in Washington, and a realization that the corruption and dishonesty that has been around now for some years is not the way the country can go. What I say in the book, and I still feel it, is that the debate has been moved partly because of the race issues and partly because of McCarthy so far to the right that a lot of the issues that should be discussed are not being discussed. We're not discussing how to maintain American industry in an era of globalization. We're not discussing how to have an equitable country. We're not discussing the kind of social services that we desperately need. And our press is telling us to look down at the Europeans who have solved a lot of these issues. So I think what we need, and this is the role of programs like this and of publishing houses like ours, is to bring out the ideas that say there are solutions. It's not hopeless. The cliches of the right, when we call welfare destruction welfare reforms, are a language which is geared to cover up what's actually happened rather than to discuss what should be happening.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Andre Schifrin, author of the brand new book, A Political Education, Coming of Age in Paris and New York, just published this month by Melville House Publishing, based out of Hoboken, New Jersey. We've only got about a minute or so left, Andre. And I thought to close, I would like you describe yourself, and it's evident in your comments that you are a political junkie and a media junkie, a print media junkie. You consume a lot of media. What is your media diet? Where do you turn to make sense of the world?
Well, one of the things that I've discovered living in France for half of a year is how different the press can be in Europe from what we see here. And it's made me feel all the sadder that our American newspapers are so limited in what they report and the issues that they consider valid for discussion. So one has to look at the foreign press as well as looking as one can at the BBC and the evening news programs and the major American papers. But as one does look at them, one cannot help but feel, in that respect, growing despair about how much worse they're getting. And if the newspapers are having fewer and fewer readers, as apparently is the case, we might even ask, is that in part because they've stopped covering the news in the way that an honest newspaper ought to do? So the Internet certainly is very helpful to giving resumes or access to the foreign press in the way that we've never had in the past. It's no longer a question of getting to a little newsstand on West 42nd Street. You can find all of the foreign press at your disposal on your computer.
Andre Schifrin, on that very cheerful note, I'm afraid, I'm getting the signal that our time is drawing to an end. I want to thank you very much, Andre Schifrin, for joining us today, discussing your brand new book, A Political Education. Good luck with the book, and I hope we can have you on the program again in the future.
Well, I hope so, and I thank you very much.
All right. Goodbye, everyone. I'll be back in 167 hours. Till then, take care.